for joining us. This is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Fisheries Pod. If you are the generous sort, you can be like Ben, Tyler, Janet, Robin, and John, who all support the podcast on Patreon. And through Patreon, you are able to support the show with either a recurring or one-time donation, which helps us pay for various parts of the show. If that isn't your thing, you can also purchase Fisheries Pod shirts, hoodies, stickers, and face masks on our Teespring store if you feel inclined. So check it out. Our guest today is Dr. Ben Marcy-Quay. Ben grew up in Michigan and describes his educational trajectory as an eastward migration. He earned a bachelor's degree in environmental science from Allegheny College in Western Pennsylvania, followed by both his MS and PhD from Cornell University. He is currently a postdoc at the University of Vermont, where he studies lake trout restoration in Lake Champlain. Ben's work focuses on population dynamics and often involves the application of data-rich technologies such as telemetry and genetics. Welcome to the podcast, Ben.
Hey, thanks. Good to be here.
Yeah, of course. So I guess we can get right into it. How did you first become interested in the field of fisheries?
Yeah, it was actually random chance, more or less. I've always been interested in the outdoors, and as I got older, that turned into an interest in ecology. But even from an early age, my parents did a lot of camping, especially all through northern Canada. So I was always interested in nature. And when undergrad rolled around, environmental science just seemed like a natural fit. And after graduation, I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. So I looked at just sort of general environmental science jobs. And I ended up doing some biodiversity monitoring with New York DEC, the state's Department of Environment. And that was largely focused on vernal pools, herpetology, which I'd done a little bit of volunteering in undergrad.
Yeah.
But what I didn't realize was it was connected to Cornell University, which is really involved with the program. And after about a year there, my boss's boss needed a master's student to do some fisheries modeling. And I guess she liked the work I was doing, so she recommended me. And I just ended up becoming a master's student doing fisheries modeling, having no real experience with fisheries or modeling before.
That's awesome. Just type it right in.
An interesting choice, but it seems to have stuck and worked out.
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah, so that got me into it. And I just discovered that, I always loved the outdoors, and fisheries is a great way to work in beautiful places. And the modeling aspect actually turned out to be really cool. Sort of happenstance, but like a lot of things in science. Also networking, getting to know people through other people, and figuring out about opportunities that you might never know of otherwise.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I know, I always like to hear how people got started, just because I think I took a sort of roundabout path to get into fisheries. So it's always fun to find out, where they made the jump, I guess.
Yep. Yeah. Most people I talk to have somewhat of a roundabout path, whether it's they've always been interested in science, but they did other kinds of science before they figured out about fish. Or sometimes I run into people who have always loved to fish. At some point in life, they realize, wait, this is...
I can study this. And speaking of networking, we met at Cornell, and I guess through that AFS Reno conference.
Yes.
But I would love it if you could walk me through the projects that you worked on in your time at Cornell, what systems you studied, and the research questions that you were investigating.
Yeah, be happy to. Well, as I said, I came to Cornell for a master's project. And that was already funded by the state through the New York USGS Cooperative Unit, which is sort of a liaison between academic institutions and state government groups, using sort of federal money to make those connections and support that. Mm-hmm. And that project was already pretty well laid out. And the idea was that New York State sustains recreational fishing in streams by stocking trout. A lot of brown trout, also some rainbow trout, some brook trout. Mm-hmm. And since way back when, I think as early as 1950s, 1960s, they make the decisions about what to stock and where to stock it based on a model that tries to achieve a certain average catch rate for anglers. The idea that an angler is happy if they catch a fish every 2 hours, which seems like a convenient number, so I'm not sure where that came from. And so they try to stock fish at the start of the season so that there's an average number of fish throughout the fishing season, despite losses to predation and anglers keeping fish, that throughout the fishing season, everybody's happy.
Makes sense.
Yeah. And so this was around 2010, and they realized that the model they've been using was 50, 60 years old, and probably used some updating, both in terms of more interesting techniques, but also just sort of basic re-estimation. It was based on assumptions from the 1960s and 70s. So I was the student side of a big project that had been laid out that involved quantitative assessments in streams, a lot of electrofishing before stocking, after stocking, throughout the season, to get a sense of what was happening to these stocked fish. Mm-hmm. As well as an angler component where they were doing creel surveys all throughout the season on a set of chosen study streams throughout the state to see what the angler side of the experience was, as well as what was actually happening to the stocked fish.
Oh, I see. Awesome.
Yeah. So it was cool. It was some of my firsthand field experience, field experience in fisheries.
Yeah.
But also much more modeling. There was a lot of data coming in from a bunch of collaborators and great state biologists and managers going out and doing the work. And I was trying to use that original framework, but update it and re-estimate things and discover that, for example, catch and release fishing is a thing when previously it had been estimated that 90% of the fish that were caught were kept because that's what was done in the 60s. Yeah, that was a really fun project. I think it was useful for New York in guiding policy changes that are happening even now, and useful for me to get my feet wet, so to speak.
Fishery science. That's awesome. It sounds like, pretty challenging project, but definitely one that has a big impact.
Yes. Yeah, it took a little bit to get up to speed, but once I did, it was a lot of fun.
Nice.
And then after that, I decided to stay at Cornell for my PhD because I was really enjoying what I was doing. But I started working with a different group doing fisheries work in the Adirondacks. And that's the Adirondack Fisheries Research Program, which is another long-term thing at Cornell. They've also been around since the 50s. And that was a chance to develop my own independent research. I think masters can be great because they're short enough that there has to be a bit of a framework already in place before you come on as a student. And that helps you avoid some of the mistakes that people can make early on and create a template in your mind for how to design a project and run a project. And then you can go on to a PhD and hit the ground running because you've already got that experience.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So for me, I was interested in doing more native fish work, but taking those same modeling and population dynamics concepts forward. And in the Adirondacks, acid precipitation has been a really big issue. The age-old story, well, not age-old, but the old story of pollution coming from the Midwest, traveling east, hitting the first sort of elevated terrain that it comes across, which is the southwestern Adirondacks, falling as precipitation in a region that happens to be mostly rock and not have much soil to buffer things. So a lot of lakes in the Adirondacks were pretty much wiped out by acid rain in the 1970s and 80s. Yeah, it's also a really cool success story because the Clean Air Act Amendment of 1990 brought about real noticeable changes. And so by the time I got involved with that group, they've been doing a lot of work on the restoration of the region where pH is rising and these ponds can support life again. And so my project revolved around a few different areas, as PhD projects tend to do. They mushroom over time. But looking at native species, especially brook trout and lake trout, as well as some other less charismatic species, like white sucker, which I think are fascinating.
Love suckers.
Really cool.
A very glamorous name, but they are pretty cool.
Yes. They're everywhere. Yeah, I think because they're tough to catch, they don't get as much recognition, but especially white sucker are super abundant in a lot of lakes. And I think ignoring them is a bit like ignoring the deer. They're the grazers that in the food web that, are ubiquitous, but if you don't look for them, you don't really know that major component is there. And one of the more interesting pieces of my PhD research was actually looking at brook trout restoration using a fun technique called close-kin market capture, which is spring of the last 5 or 6 years, which is taking market capture, which is a popular, it's a pretty common method of estimating abundance, especially in the absolute abundance. But doing it from a genetic sense, where you catch a bunch of individuals, you look at the relationships between them using essentially paternity and maternity tests, and then using the density of observed relationships to estimate the size of the underlying population, which is both a really simple concept. You know, it's you're more likely to find two related individuals in a small town than you are in New York City. But also quite complex in practice. But there are a lot of really interesting advantages. So I was using some of the Adirondack restoration to both validate that technique in small freshwater systems, so see what's happening as these systems are recovering from acid precipitation and we're actually starting to get sustainable populations again. So that ended up being the major component of my PhD.
Wow, that's so interesting.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's fun to see where research projects like that go, too. I think if you'd asked me at the start of my PhD what my dissertation would have looked like, I would have been able to give you the region and the species and some general concepts. But all the interesting intricacies of that evolved over the course of it, which was really fun.
Yeah, I know. I'm early on in that evolution myself, so
it's a grand adventure.
Yeah, it sounds like an exciting and difficult process.
It's difficult, but it's also fun. A lot of what I like about ecology and science is solving puzzles. You know, different people are in the field for different reasons, but for me, I really love puzzles. Ecology offers some of the most interesting puzzles, the stuff that's around us every day, hidden in plain sight, trying to figure out how it all works. And I think fisheries is especially interesting because water is such a black box. You know, you can have a pond, right outside your house, and you know it's there, you know exactly where its boundaries are, you know there are probably fish in it, and you know the fish don't move it unless there's an outlet.
Yep.
But beyond that, even knowing a lot about fisheries, I'd be hard pressed to tell you exactly what species are in there and mm-hmm. what the relative abundances are, besides sketching out the basics of, well, in this area, there's normally bass, something like that. Mm-hmm. So from a puzzle enthusiast perspective, you get this really well-defined problem.
Mm-hmm.
And then you know absolutely nothing about what's inside of it.
Yeah, it's a perfect system to come up with questions.
Yeah.
Sure. And it is interesting too, just talking about, I guess, those pollution effects coming out of the Midwest kind of brings me back to growing up as a kid swimming in the Ohio River. During the time that I think it was probably the most polluted waterway in the United States, I think.
Yeah, you're lucky to have survived.
A good few years. Yeah, I haven't sprouted another head or anything yet. But it is interesting to me, I think, you know, in aquatic systems, how some of those effects, human effects, can go pretty unnoticed.
Yeah.
But how big an impact they have is pretty cool.
Yeah, it's one of the interesting bits and also the trickier bits about ecology, I think, is that we only notice the problems after they've been happening for a while.
And yeah, when it becomes something we have to fix.
Yeah. And when we learn science in elementary school, middle school, you know, it's always you design an experiment and it's well controlled.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got, you know, if you're going to do some sort of time thing, you've got before and after and your data perfectly collected all along. And sometimes you can do that in ecology every so often.
Yeah, sometimes.
But for the most part, we say, oh, wow, something's happening. We should have been looking at this 10 years ago.
Yeah, we wish we had many more years of data on this.
Yep, which makes the statistics interesting, mm-hmm. And questions interesting, but certainly complicates things a lot.
Mm-hmm. But it is exciting to, I think, kind of address pressing problems too. So.
Oh yeah, yeah, for sure. Really to be at the forefront of the things that matter in the world.
Yeah.
So.
No, that's awesome.
I'm pretty into my field.
Yeah, I feel you. I mean, we are on the fisheries podcast, so.
That's true. We probably count as enthusiasts just to start.
And speaking of puzzles, could you next walk me through kind of what you're currently working on at UVM?
Yes.
Yeah. Study species, where you're working, what you're hoping to learn, and all of that.
Yeah, all the basics. Mm-hmm. Obviously it may change over time, but
yeah
the general parameters are, so I'm a postdoc at the University of Vermont. I've been here for probably about 9 months now, so I got to transition jobs during COVID, which was interesting in all sorts of ways. I'm actually like discovering there's a lab and going mm-hmm. in as people.
Yeah. I know exactly how that feels.
But people keep asking me, like, oh, wasn't it strange, like, starting this job during COVID? I'm like, well, I have only lived in Vermont and been part of this group since COVID, so I don't know anything else.
Yeah, I have nothing to compare it to. Yeah, exactly.
But it's fun to actually now, like, have coworkers who are more than a face on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, I came here to study lake trout restoration.
Mm-hmm.
So lake trout are a native top predator in Lake Champlain, which is, if you're not familiar with the region, this giant, well, it's not Great Lakes giant, but this very large lake.
Yeah.
Between Vermont and New York, and touching a little bit of Quebec at the top.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, lake trout have been the dominant native predator there, but really early in the 1900s, they were wiped out by overfishing.
Mm.
Since the 1970s, the fishery has been sustained by annual stocking. So both Vermont and New York coordinate to toss in fish from their hatcheries
mm-hmm.
Every year. And when they started doing that, the thought was, okay, we stocked some fish and they survived here before, so they'll survive and reproduce now.
and we'll get a beautiful self-sustaining population. As it turns out, things aren't always that simple in the real world. So much of the past few decades has been trying to figure out why lake trout don't successfully recruit these days in Champlain. And thinking about ways that maybe we could actually bring about self-sustaining population.
Yeah.
Then about in 2015, they actually started seeing wild fish. Yeah, all of a sudden appearing.
So what changed?
That's an excellent question. The last 5 years, I think, has been spent saying, why are fish recruiting?
Yeah.
Wow. It's the opposite question. And so far, the answer has been the same. Just, I don't know. It isn't bad. Or
shrug.
Yep. So my PI here, Ellen Marsden, has been spent most of her career studying lake trout restoration throughout the Great Lakes and in Champlain. So she thinks this is a fun twist on, you know, the next step of, wait, now they are restoring.
Yeah.
What's happening? And I'm coming in to look at that from a population dynamics perspective. One half of that is just figuring out what's contributing to the wild population. And that technique I mentioned earlier, close kin market capture, is a really interesting way to look at that, because it lets you estimate the parental population contributing to a group of juveniles and younger cohorts. So get a sense of, is this two fish that just figured out the right spot to spawn? Or is it a sudden systemic shift? And I'm hoping to use that genetic-based technique to dig into the wild side. What's out there? Why is it happening? Really, how resilient is it? The other half of that is the stocking side. So New York and Vermont throw in a set number of fish, I think about 60, 70,000 every year, no matter what's happening. And if you've suddenly got a wild reproducing population successfully recruiting into the fishery, then all the assumptions you based your stocking numbers on sort of go out the window.
Yeah, it's no longer the same situation.
Yep, and what you don't want to do with a big predator is overstock. Then you crack on your prey base. All the other predators, you know, the walleye, the Atlantic salmon, also crash. Weird things happen, and none of them are good.
Yeah, lots of competition.
Yep. And lake trout are especially tricky from that perspective, because they have a lot of predatory inertia. That is, they live for, in some systems, up to 70 years. In Champlain, easily up to mid-20s into the 30s. And they only start to reproduce around age 6, 7. So if you overstock a system, you may not see that effect for a long time. And then all of a sudden, everything will go haywire.
Yeah.
And unlike something like Pacific salmon, where you can count on them all dying at a convenient point in the near future.
Yeah, once you get that delayed reaction, it's a big boom for a long time.
Yep. So on the stock side, I'm interested in seeing how the stock fish actually perform, especially New York and Vermont, while they coordinate their stocking.
Yeah.
They also use slightly different strategies. And so if we're thinking about adjusting management in the future, it's good to know how the individual components work. So that, to use the old lever analogy, you know what happens when you pull these specific levers, you know, move this side of the stocking up or down. So that's my postdoc in a nutshell, really.
Evolving. That's exciting.
It's fun. It's fun to move into a new region. I've done a lot of my master's work was inland streams, and then I went to small inland lakes, and now I'm working on large inland lakes.
Big inland lakes.
So who knows what the next step will be? Great Lakes, the ocean?
Maybe the ocean one day.
That's coming from the Florida perspective, right?
Yeah, exactly. No, I've gone all marine.
You know, It happens to the best. Oh my God. It happens sometimes. I've dabbled a little bit in the marine realm. Mm-hmm. I did a little bit of work with summer flounder.
Yes.
Some work with your data.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That actually sets me up for a great transition. So thank you.
No problem.
But your mentorship during my undergrad, when I was working on my thesis on cobia of the East Coast of the U.S., was really a huge help. And I'd love to hear more about your involvement kind of in that other side of science where, you know, you're working as a mentor and also communicating your work to either, you know, students or the public and other scientists.
Yeah, I think the short answer to that is to say that I want to be doing more mentorship and more science communication. I think it's a skill I'm building over time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's hugely important. You know, it's like it or not, learning how to do science is really something you learn from experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so mentorship is a major component of that. Unfortunately, mentorship is also something you really only learn from experience.
Yeah.
So it was great that during my graduate work, I got the chance to mentor a few undergraduates, yourself mm-hmm. included, because for me, that was a really valuable experience. And I'm glad it seems to have worked out. And I hadn't made too many mistakes in the process.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely very valuable for me as well. It was super, super helpful. So.
Yeah. And if you're a graduate student listening to this, try and find a way to mentor, especially undergrads, if your school has an honors thesis program. Because it's a really great experience. And now that I'm postdoc, I'm involved in both mentoring undergraduates, but also graduate students.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been fun to extend those skills, but also really rely on what I learned during my graduate work. And down the road, I'm thinking about building a lab someday. And mm-hmm. so how to do that right is something I spend a lot of time thinking about. I don't have all the answers, but
yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, thinking and watching what others do. The communication side of that
mm-hmm.
is, those are almost two separate questions, although I guess they're wrapped up because especially getting people interested in the field, communication is key. Like most researchers, I wish I did SciComm better. The long and short of it is that it's a lot of work. It's mm-hmm. a full-time job.
Yeah, it's definitely a non-negligible time commitment, that's for sure.
Yeah. So which is why I'm really glad that things like Fisheries Podcast exist mm-hmm. that can are coordinated efforts to get that information out there. Communicating to other researchers, attending conferences is huge. I really enjoy that. I'm really looking forward to in-person conferences again in the near future.
Yes, me too.
And social media has been great too, although I'm not as active on there as I should be.
Mm-hmm. One day we'll get you on the Twitter train.
We will see. I resisted this long.
Yep. No, you're holding out. You're doing better than me.
But there are, for example, the lab group I'm part of has a group Instagram account. And that's really nice. Anytime you can share it alone and kind of take turns sharing pieces of your research, I think works really well. So I'm hopeful to do more of that. And then where I am here in Vermont, there's actually a lot of stakeholder interest and larger opportunities to get research findings and conclusions out there and actually discuss them with the public. So that's been great. And I'm looking forward to doing more of that in the future.
Yeah, that's excellent. I know that's something that I think also drew me into fisheries when I was getting my start because I worked with, you know, like lobstermen in Maine and fisheries managers up there. And I think it was just so exciting for me to see the human side of things and how, you know, you can get scientists to kind of communicate about the system with the stakeholders, and then they provide their insights and when it works well. So it's
yeah.
fun to foster those connections.
I think fisheries has an especially diverse and interesting set of stakeholders, depending on the systems you're working in.
Mm-hmm.
You've got recreational anglers, you've got commercial fishermen, everything from independent operators up to big corporations.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the aesthetic side, people who just like nearby with fish in them, theoretically.
Mm-hmm.
You've got all sorts of interests. I think there's something deep in the human brain about wanting to be near water.
Yes.
Which probably worked
out
well.
I'm definitely wired that way.
Same. And so it reaches a ton of different groups, and there's a lot of opportunities to share one's research and for one's research to be impactful to all sorts of people. So that's a really fun aspect of it.
That's excellent. And then I think we're to my last question for the easier part of the interview. But since, you know, you've moved around and I'm sure you do some other things than just science. So could you describe for us some of your interests and hobbies outside of fisheries?
Sure. Yeah, as I said earlier, I'm very much outdoor oriented.
Mm-hmm.
So I really like hiking. And since moving to the region I'm in now, I've been also with pandemic closing down a lot of things. I've been spending a lot of time hiking. I'm actually trying to work my way through the Adirondack 46ers right now.
Oh, nice.
Which, yeah, after spending 5 years studying Adirondack fish, I actually hadn't spent much time hiking in the region.
Yeah.
So I'm very much into that. I'm a beekeeper. So,
oh, that's so cool. I had no idea.
Yeah, it's also fun. It's a little bit like taking one's work into one's personal life because it's really just population management.
Yeah, it's basically an ecology job.
Yeah, which feels a little weird sometimes, but it's really fun to, you know, I've had a couple hives in the past and sort of keeping them going, figuring out what dynamics are there and then getting way too much honey in the process has been a lot of fun.
Oh, I mean, of course.
You gotta have some benefit.
Yeah. Oh, that's so neat. Do you, I guess, get honey from your hives or do anything with them?
Yeah.
You know, the materials they produce, or is it just to kind of support pollinator communities?
It's somewhat to support pollinators, but also certainly the agricultural aspect and the honey collection aspect. A well-managed beehive way overproduces the honey they need to survive through winter.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I've got probably 5 gallons of acidity in my basement right now.
Wow. That's awesome.
Yeah, I haven't played with doing anything with beeswax yet, but
one day. with all that free time, I'm sure you have.
Exactly. And then I also really like to travel. So I've hit 6 out of 7 continents and hoping to do some more of that in the near future. And I spent a bunch of time traveling through the US and camping and hiking. And, it's a nice, I find it really helps my brain to get off the grid and stop looking at my email for a bit and just explore the place.
Yeah, I definitely agree on that one. I know I'm, I think, starting an era of road tripping around the States probably now that I have a dog and won't be flying with him. But
it's a good year to road trip.
Yes. Oh, for sure. I'll have to get some travel recommendations from you at some point.
Oh, for sure. I've got a long list.
Awesome. And I think with that, my questions are done. So we can move on to the easier part of the interview with our final few questions that they ask at the end of each show.
Okay.
So the first one is pretty straightforward. If you had to pick a favorite fish, which one would it be?
You know, you call these the easier part.
I know, it's objectively so much harder.
Much, much harder. I mean, even if I could give you a favorite fish, I think it would, you know, might change tomorrow.
Yeah.
So instead, I'll give you a favorite order.
Perfect. I'll take it.
I think catfish are really cool. Mm-hmm. The amount of adaptation in that group is absolutely amazing. You've got some of the largest freshwater fish in the world. Mm-hmm. You have tiny little nightmares like Candiru. Yeah. Many of them are venomous.
Oh, I did not know that.
Oh, yeah. So they've got those little grooved spines. Some can actually use it to deliver venom. If you ever pick up a catfish, be very careful. Yeah,
keep that in mind. Got it.
A few can shock you. So there's that.
That's cool.
Walking catfish, which maybe you're becoming familiar with in Florida.
I've yet to encounter any.
They'll happily breathe air for a while and wander from one water bottle to the next.
Wow.
There's at least one European species that's been recorded luring in pigeons from the banks of rivers and then eating them.
Oh no, team bird.
Yep. That's yep, so team funny. Fish is winning that one.
Yeah.
There's just an amazing range of adaptation. You know, they've got no scales, but some groups have just evolved these giant armor plates.
Yeah.
I've never actually studied them, so it feels like a bit of a cop-out to list a favorite that I haven't really worked with. But I think someday
get in there. And I mean, I picked a fish that I've, you know, not really written anything up about, but I've just interacted with them. I said mummy chogs because I think they're cool.
That's a good
and adorable. But I like catfish. This is enlightening. I'm gonna have to research more about catfishes.
They're incredible. Now, of course, the list of interesting fish is very long. So sculpin almost made
the list of fish in general is very long. So I love sculpin.
Oh yeah. They're super cool. I would also love to do some work with deep water sculpin or
like Lake Baikal or something like that.
I was just about to say that if I could find my way out to Lake Baikal at some point, that would be pretty cool.
True. Yeah, add that to the bucket list. That would be so cool.
Oh yeah.
If you're working on a project there one day, let me know. And come back from the ocean.
Definitely.
Awesome. All right. So next up, I've got, what is your favorite memory from your research career so far?
Yeah, these really aren't the easy questions.
I know. I'm trying to make it sound like they are. They're so much harder. It's like, please summarize the best moments of your life. Thank you.
Yeah. I've had a lot of fun doing fieldwork of various sorts. There's the concept of type 1 fun and type 2 fun, which is type 1 fun is fun while you're doing it, and type 2 fun is fun after you're done doing it. Mm-hmm. And I think fieldwork tends to hover right in between the type of day. So maybe more of a feeling than a memory. Any early morning when I'm on a boat leaving the dock, smells a little bit like diesel or gas. I've got hot coffee about to go out.
Coffee is key.
Yes, very much so. I'm actually really enjoying working at larger boats now because they come with coffee makers.
Oh, wow.
It's missing on small skiffs.
Mm-hmm.
Any time when it's the morning, I'm about to do a long day of field work, get my hands slimy, and it's just the start of it, is a really good moment. Similarly, I used to do a bunch of night electrofishing in small mountain lakes. And that was really cool. You shut off the generator and there's just absolutely crazy numbers of stars overhead. And once again, hot coffee. Those are really good moments and memories.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. And I'm just thinking about, being in rural New York for school, just how many stars we had there. It was very beautiful.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, it's actually moving up to Vermont. There's even a few more, it feels like. I feel very lucky for that.
That's awesome.
Like I said, one of the cool things about fisheries is you get to go to beautiful places.
Yes. That's definitely a selling point.
Yeah.
All right. So I guess speaking of going to beautiful places for fisheries, what would be kind of your, I guess, either dream job or dream location?
Yeah, dream job is tough. The science job market being what it is, it's hard to where one will end up. So I would love to do a study at some point, like a longer term multi-year study that's whole Arctic, sort of speaking of Lake Baikal. I'd love to look at climate change impacts all across the northern latitudes, get a big set of study sites of like small inland waters in Canada, northern Europe, through Russia and Siberia. Something, you know, some mix of species like char or pike, that either the species itself has a distribution all through there, or there are sort of similar species with the same function. Really dig into what's happening in all of those systems, because they're changing rapidly. Now is the time to look at them, and I think we're starting to get to the techniques where we can do so efficiently, and get far enough back in time to just see the start of these huge signals that are coming from climate impacts in northern latitudes. I have no idea who would fund it, but you know, it's the problem with those big projects is you got to find a funder.
Yeah, there's got to be money, but that would be incredible. And, you know, relating back to our discussion of having data kind of before we need it to address a big problem would be so nice.
And we're at the cusp of that. And it would also be a really grand adventure. I would selfishly love to visit all those regions. That's a piece of it too, but I think it's the right time for a huge study like that, and that would be kind of my dream project if I were to pitch something now.
That would be incredible.
It's keep my fingers crossed. I have no idea what comes next after a postdoc, so maybe I'll find a way to
TBD. All right. And then my last question, if there was one point or principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
I went back and forth on this one. This is probably going to be a more boring principle.
That's okay.
Yeah. And I'm going to be passionate about it. So you're going to have to play. Data management. And not just... good data management, like put your data in a database and have great metadata so people can figure out what you did before. That's a huge part of it. That's what we talk about a lot. But data compatibility, and I think really getting down to how you collect the data, and more specifically, data sheets, which we all make and use. And sometimes they're beautifully designed for a specific study. Other times they're done the night before because you think, oh crap, I need something to write down my, what I collect on. I think there's a real tendency for, especially in academic groups, for people to come in, design a specific data sheet for their project, usually goes into an Excel file that they store just on their computer, and who knows what happens when they move on to a new position. And yet groups will often research the same system or the same species or the same concept with a bunch of different projects. And I think if I could program into more people the thought that, okay, I'm starting what may be a longer term series of projects, I'm going to create a flexible data sheet that can be used for whatever comes about in the future. I think it'd be hugely helpful. It solves a lot of issues in, you know, training people to enter data that are coming from all sorts of different data sheets. It lets you put it into that beautiful grand master database that we talk about so much with good data management. And it means that if you have collaborators coming in with a related project, you can just hand them something and say, hey, here, use this data sheet. And it's perfectly compatible with the data you're already collecting. We all want long-term data sets. And I think that's the way to do it.
It's something that I think state and federal groups tend to do pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And academic groups, because we're more like herding cats, don't do so well.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's the one thing. It's something I learned from one of the first labs I was part of, and I'm now trying to take with me and bring to other groups. The idea of a beautiful general master data sheet that can be used for all sorts of products, I think, is hugely powerful.
Yeah, no, that is true. It just makes everyone's life so much easier.
It does. It saves so much time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's instead of every researcher, you know, making their own data sheet, they can just go to the spot where they're all stored, and you know, it's got, you skip half the columns and put information in the other half, and it's got to be flexible enough.
Yeah.
But by and large, we all collect a lot of the same data.
Mm-hmm.
Length, weight, tag numbers, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's my big concept that I'll rant about whenever I'm given the
chance. I think that is a very, very important principle. So I support that one.
That's also me being a kind of a data guy when it comes to analysis. So
yeah.
It's more fun to be handed the organized stuff.
Yes, that is true. Yeah, I've been working to recover some historical data, and that has been quite the adventure.
Oh,
yeah. Working back through people's README files and such. So.
Ooh, yeah, back to the historical data. The stuff, when you go back to the 1800s, that's fun. You know, it's more someone's narrative.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the era of just partial README files and strangely named Excel files. That's a
yes. It's an interesting world.
Hopefully getting some interesting stuff out of it though.
Yes, ideally. We'll see.
Fingers crossed.
Yes. All right. Well, that's all the questions I have. So Ben, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. It was a pleasure to hear about you and all of your work. If people want to find more information on you or get a hold of you through social media or online, how should they go about doing that?
As I said earlier, my social media game isn't as strong as it probably should be. I do post some fishery stuff on my Instagram, which is bmq215.
Mm-hmm.
But my main web presence is my website, which I update relatively often.
Awesome.
That's www.benmq.com.
Great.
Yeah. So, and there's contact information if people want that there. You can also find me on University of Vermont's website. And yeah, I'm happy to talk to anyone who has questions or is interested in delving a little bit deeper into some of this stuff. So feel free to reach out.
Awesome. And for listeners, if you would like to get a hold of me or the other host of the Fisheries Pod, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at Fisheries Pod, or old-fashioned email at feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app, or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget, you can help support the podcast with a monthly contribution through Patreon or buy some awesome Fisheries Podcast logo shirts, hoodies, stickers, and more available on Teespring. I'm Hannah. Thank you for listening to the 129th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember the importance of data management and compassion.